PM, and I'm Councilman Bill Bell, co-chairman of our Public Safety County Council. I'd like to call this meeting to order. My legislative aide, Karen Barlow, will be taking minutes and is on with us. We have an attendance, and I'm just going to go from left to right. Councilwoman Diller, Councilman Cartier, Councilman Carter. We have Councilman Smiley, Councilwoman Kilpatrick, Councilman Sheldon, Councilman Woods, and Councilwoman Durham, Councilman Tackett. We also have with us today Vaughn Vaughn, our Colonel and Chief of Police, Chief Jeff Miller, as well as our newly appointed Chief Mark Logeman. And so with that, what's your pleasure of the minutes from the previous meeting?
Motion to approve is provided.
Second.
Motion made and seconded to approve the minutes as posted and provided. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So carried. Okay, first on the agenda is 20-073, amend the grants budget, appropriate $375,000 to the contracted police duty revolving fund, which is administered by the Department of Public Safety. Is Councilman Street on board yet?
I don't see him.
Okay. With that being said, I'll say as per title. And we'll go to the update on emergency communications 911 center. And Chief Miller will be covering the response to COVID-19.
Councilman Bell, the council president is now in.
Okay, I thank you, Councilman. Council President Hartley Nagel is in attendance, and Chief Miller will be presenting response to COVID-19, 911 center call volume, and call processing times. Chief Miller.
Good afternoon, Council. Yes, Jeff Miller, Chief of Emergency Communications, and I thank you for the opportunity to update you once again about where we are or current or how we're responding to the COVID crisis. Our staffing, our call volumes have been quite different than in past years, and our call processing times are looking more improved because we're handling less calls. But I'm going to share my screen, and if anyone can see it, I hope it works well.
It's good.
Thank you. So current staffing, I'll do a quick update on our telecommunicator academy. That's been on hold because of COVID-19, but our staffing still stands at 95. We're still at operating with operational strength of 88 with an actual 77. We have 11 hard vacancies still. We have hired 4 new people since January. They are still in the training process. That training process has taken longer because of some challenges with priority dispatch and getting people to fly in and get our all the training that they need to be certified to do their job. But we are working through that, and we're looking at ways to do it remotely. And then we just made one public safety operator tentative offer yesterday, and we're waiting here to hear back from that individual. We are looking to provide a Citizens Academy again as soon as reasonably possible. It will probably be a Zoom learning experience. I don't see us spending 8 hours a day on a computer trying to learn the technical ins and outs of the 911 center. I do envision us going to maybe shorter segments of 2 hours a day, so that will take longer to accomplish the academy. However, then we'll get everyone tested 3 days before, and then we'll bring them in and let them have the actual hands-on experience to be in the 911 center. As you know, we've spent a lot of money, time, and effort in decontaminating our 911 center, making it a safe zone, and we've been committed to keeping it a safe zone. And luckily, you know, thus far, out of all the testing we've done for the 96 employees that I'm responsible for, we've had one person positive, and that person was immediately removed from the system. We did a quick decontamination of the area that that person had been exposed to. And I'll give you some ideas of what we have available to us. We are also looking at possibly a September outside open house with all the current distancing processes in play. That's not final yet, but we are looking at doing something like that. As you know, I think I briefed you last month that we did purchase a biomist decontamination machine. We use it every Friday in the staff area to keep the staff offices and everything clean or as clean as possible. And we use it on the door handles and the things that are commonly used throughout the 911 center. And we have had the need to decontaminate a workstation because of a employee's potential exposure. We are conducting temperature and wellness checks. As you know, we were the first division within Newcastle County to begin taking temperatures. And I'll thank Chief Logaman. They turned us on to a item called a Seek Scan. It's a thermal imaging system that's been installed at the entrance of the EOC or the Emergency Operations Center. So employees don't walk into the 911 center anymore. They report to the EOC first. They have to walk through the thermal imaging scan, get their temperature verified. If it does give a negative temperature, then or a temperature that we have set as an alarm, which is anything 99.5 or above, we will reconfirm that with a different portable device. And if they answer two of any of the wellness check questions, they'll be released to go home and not come into the 911 center. So we've gone out of our way, and I really have to thank our team for being overly cautious and responsible in, you know, big investment to make the room clean to begin with, but everyone's doing their part to keep it clean. And then this is just a diagram, a tip. This is what it looks like. They walk through those two blocks on a tripod there. And if the thing gives you a green check, you're good to go. Otherwise, it'll beep and flash red. And that way the supervisor who's in the room will know that person needs to be taken aside and get their temperature double checked. So to that point, I'll move to call processing and times. So the first I'm showing you here might be a little difficult to read, but we're looking at 3 weeks of EMS incidents. These are ALS and MBLS combined, including those in the Wilmington Fire Department system. So right here where I'm highlighting in the top, the week of 6/15, there were 1,470 calls. The week of 6/22, there were 1,500. These are just EMS calls. With then we go into the week of 6/29. So for the most part, over at the week of 6/15, we had a 6.6% increase. And those were really sick patients. That's when I think things started to catch up. And I'm sure Chief Logaman will confirm this with me. People that weren't going to get the necessary regular visits at their doctor or checkups, that started to catch up, and we saw a significant spike. And we've continued to see the calls increase, 2% more the following week and another 1.1 on top of last week. And then we're trying to create a new different dashboard and make it available in our biweekly report. But we're also looking at the top five calls, and most of them are sick people, followed by Bravo type, or you're somewhat more serious. And then right here on the left side, where my mouse is, the Delta breathing problems. It's in the top five on the week where we were at 6.6% increase. And the Delta means that's an ALS response. So that's where the serious illnesses are starting to show themselves. I move on to police incidents, and we're looking at the same slightly different period. I'm sorry, 6/8, 6/15, and the week of 622, but the grand totals for overall police, and these are just CAD incidents. This isn't the actual police agency and their totals. This is what we do for them in CAD. A 4.3% decrease. The following week was a 4.2% increase, followed by a 3.4% decrease. And I'm pretty sure the colonel will agree that although we see less call volume, the critical calls are they're that much more serious. Domestics were number one for the first week's period, followed by fireworks. The second week, fireworks beat domestics, and an anomaly there is fireworks was in second place the last week with 157 complaints in a week, and with the same number, they went to number one in the second week, and then naturally on 622 through 628, we went to 400 fireworks complaints, which seriously trumped the domestics. To look at a brief snapshot of overall 911 calls, and these are calls that are answered in 10 seconds or less. And again, we use an automatic call distributor, meaning the calls get distributed around the room evenly, so no one person is answering more than others. But in the last 14 days, we've met the NFPA standard of 90% or more at 91.58. In the last month, we've been at 93.73. And I'd like to highlight that year to date at 94.17. The reason we're at 94.17 is we're still processing between 300 and 400 less calls per day than we were the first week of March. And it, you know, it just goes to show that if you got the right number of people with the right call volume, we're going to continue to meet that trend and that standard. And we were meeting that trend. We did it all year last year, and we were doing it because we have power shifts. We're staffing during the right time of the day. We changed the way we answer our phone calls. So we were meeting a standard. We're just far exceeding the standard at this point due to less calls. And then I'll point out that we had a total of 17 text messages in the two-week period. And actually, nine of those were emergencies. So we have seen an uptick in the text messages, rather than just being a test to see if it works, actually being a true complaint or a request for 911 services. And our 911 call operators provided CPR, life-saving instructions over the phone 16 times in that 14-day period. That's all I have. That's just a quick, brief update of where we are from COVID to our call volume and our call processing. And I'm open for any questions.
Okay, thank you, Chief. Questions from County Council?
Hi.
Councilman Cartier?
Yes, thank you, Chief, for that update on the 911 center. Really interesting. My question is, what is going on with the opiate overdose situation? Is that falling off on the radar screen? Are we still in the midst of that? It's sort of been eclipsed. I know COVID has really taken up the bandwidth out there, but where are we with that?
So, sorry, I can tell you by the data that they're not in the top five right now. But they certainly have not fallen off the screen. I literally get a text message every time there's an overdose in Newcastle County. And I have not seen a reduction in my text messages. And I'm pretty sure Chief Logeman would be better to answer, because as you know, many times when we get a phone call, you know, those 16 CPRs I reported in the 14-day period, I would venture to guess at least 25% of those were overdoses, because we don't know it's an overdose at the 911 call. We just get that unconscious person that needs CPR and intervention until the first arrival responds.
Thank you for that, and I'll drill down more on that with the paramedic update. Thank you.
Okay, other questions from council?
Yes, please.
Okay, Councilman.
Chief Miller, I just want to make sure, because it's projected, not scheduled yet, on the Citizens Academy. Budgetarily, your department's okay with, you know, you have the funding, or you're moving it from one thing to cover another. I'm just curious, I want to make sure you've got what you need for this.
I will be putting in for a form for assistance this year as well, to get the materials necessary to conduct the class, sir.
Okay, just send me your grant application, please. I'll make sure I keep some on hold.
Sure. I greatly appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, and we definitely want to recognize the efforts of Councilman Smiley in the past, and it's important in supporting this program each year. So thank you, Councilman. Any other questions from County Council for Chief Miller?
Council President.
Council President Hartley Nagel.
You're muted.
Mute it.
There we go. Great work, Chief. I just wanted to ask if I could get a copy of the presentation. Really good information. Thank you.
Absolutely. As soon as we're done.
Efforts appreciated.
I will send it to the administrative aide, Karen Barlow.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Councilman Carter, Bell.
Councilman Carter, I don't know whether it's Brother Chief Zoom is still up on the screen, but I've kind of lost access to the members.
That's right. We work together.
Yeah. All right,
Councilman Carter, you purchased the Biomass system, and I've had a few inquiries that I've done it and started doing a little bit of work on the use of induct UV lighting systems. It's been used for some other stuff. The EPA's done a good report on it, a few others. And I'm just wondering if you've looked at it or heard anything about it, whether or not it works for COVID. It apparently works for a lot of other stuff.
I want to say when we closed the 911 center for the DECON, and we brought in the cleaning company. They recommended these UVC fans, and we needed two of them to circulate within the volume of the room, the air that had to be moved. And the good news is so we are using them. We have them in play.
Okay.
And then we have an additional HEPA filter attached to that. So the research I've done because of that, and the good news is we've not completed replacing the air conditioning system, as we all know, has been a disaster in the 911 center for years. But I'm looking at right now, I was just on the phone 2 weeks ago with Paul Fries, discussing the possibility of incorporating UVC within this replacement air handling system so that it's in the background and not some annoying fan in the room just sitting there running and you know, making a motor noise.
Well, that's good to know. I'm still doing some research on it, but some people were asking about some of our issues with schools and some of the other businesses and even in homes. And for other things, it's shown to be really promising. I just don't know that anybody's tested it on coronavirus yet. But it's promising. If I get any good research stuff, I'll make sure I send that on to you. At it as well, just because I'm real interested, and if it's something that we do find really works well, we may want to look at our building codes for other things to see whether we want to integrate it or not, if there are any problems.
Greatly appreciate it.
Other questions from council? Okay, hearing none, thank you, Chief, and we're going to move on to update on paramedics with our new Emergency Medical Services Chief, Mark Logeman. And on behalf of everyone, all of us at County Council, Chief, we know you've served as acting since October of 19 when Larry Tan retired, but we want to congratulate you on your promotion and look forward to working very closely with you as we have in the past.
Thank you, Chairman Bell. I really appreciate that. And thank you to all of Council. Many of you reached out, and I appreciate all the well wishes, and I truly do look forward to continuing a good relationship and really moving the EMS division forward. I'll begin with an update on our Paramedic Academy. As I reported, I believe at the last meeting I spoke that we ran into an issue where the national certification was a challenge for us to get due to COVID. It came down to the psychomotor portion of the testing, which was face to face, and the national registry of EMTs was holding off on that. I was able to get that arranged through Good Fellowship up in Westchester. And I'm happy to say all but three of the recruits have been able to complete that testing, which completes all of the national testing. And the three that have not completed, it's not because they fail, it's because they're unable to, one, due to injury, and then there were some COVID-related issues that prevented further testing. So we have them waiting to get an opportunity to test, and we're looking to schedule a small testing for them so they can complete. So what that means is all of those that completed that psychomotor, they have their full national testing. Everyone is continuing on in the Newcastle County field training process. I'm happy to say that two of those recruits have completed the Newcastle County field training process. They've met with the medical directors and have been approved for full paramedic licensure in Delaware. We're just holding off on badging them and putting them into full service because we are awaiting that paperwork from the National Registry that shows that they are fully certified, so we can push that to the state to get them Delaware licensed. I'm very optimistic about this group. They're showing some great skills and abilities out there in the field, and I think we're going to start to see a lot of them come out in the near future. In the meantime, we're still trying to hire certified paramedics. Obviously, the pandemic has thrown somewhat of a wrench into that. It's kind of put everybody on the back burner, but I can tell you we still have our lieutenant who handles that pushing forward. We are still getting applications, and we're processing those and doing backgrounds and moving forward and trying to do testing in a safe manner so we can get some of those people, some more certified paramedics on board. Chief Miller indicated the continued testing they're doing, or I should say screening of employees. We continue that at every paramedic station is an infrared thermometer, and everyone fills out an online screening form that goes into our database and is checked off by supervision. We also did purchase one of those Seek Scan devices. It's at our headquarters office. If anybody is interested in information about that, I'm willing to push it out. So COVID, obviously, that's been the big story. Internally, we're doing very well. Our personnel have adapted wonderfully to it. They continue to do exactly what we're asking of them, wearing the PPE appropriately when they need to. We continue to closely monitor our PPE supply. I'm confident in our supply. We have a lieutenant and another employee who closely monitor it, order when necessary, and we get to the point where I can tell you right up to the exact number of how many N95 surgical masks and gowns we have. So just to let you know that we are on top of that. You probably have seen that Newcastle County is doing COVID testing in conjunction with State Division of Public Health and DEMA. Paramedics, we have a paramedic that, a lieutenant and sergeant who have been temporarily helping out with that as you need a medical provider at those sites. They've been extremely successful at those sites. I'm very happy to see that the general public here in Newcastle County has the opportunity to go get tested regardless of symptoms, because we see many cases that are asymptomatic, and given that this virus is so contagious, it is truly necessary to find those asymptomatic people that are COVID-19 positive so they know to isolate themselves from others to help stem the spread. Every week at our cabin meetings, I always do a little bit of a public safety or a public service announcement, and that's I just urge everybody to continue their vigilance with COVID-19. We're open, you know, the people are they're out and about, traffic's back to normal. And we hear stories of COVID-19 surging in certain areas. Just urging everybody to continue their social distancing, their mask, being socially responsible. And we stress that to our employees, both inside work and outside of work, because outside of work, if people are going to, going to stores, congregating, everybody's got to be responsible and keep a close eye on what they're doing. And with that, I conclude, unless anyone has questions.
Okay, thank you, Chief. Before we go to questions, the chair wants to recognize the attendance of President Pro Tem Hollins and also our co-chairman of Public Safety Committee, Councilman Street. Questions or comments from council for Chief Logan? Councilman Cartier?
Thank you. I want to return to my question I asked Chief Miller. What is the status of our response to opiate overdoses? And I have another question. Have any of the personnel in the EMS division tested positive for COVID?
Okay, I'll start with the opiates. It's the opiates from our perspective that hasn't changed. We keep a close eye on our Narcan administrations because that really is a good gauge of what we're seeing out there. And I can report to you year to date for 2020 up until July 2nd, 269 patients received Narcan in Newcastle County. And the same time period the year prior, 2019, 246. So looking at those numbers, we're not seeing a decrease. Unfortunately, we're seeing an increase. It's an ever continuing issue. And I've said before, we had the opiate epidemic and we have a COVID pandemic on top of it, something that certainly strains the medical system. But yeah, that's still out there. It's unfortunately, I would say that it doesn't get the attention that it was because of the COVID crisis. So COVID-19 within the EMS division, I can tell you that we have had positive employees. We had a positive employee, and therefore, so we had other employees that we had concerns about because they were in close proximity to this person. So as part of the Division of Public Health guidelines, in order for a healthcare provider to return, they get it. We can do antibody testing. That's been vetted through public health. So we tested a large group of paramedics. These were paramedic recruits. And we had three individuals test positive for both the IgG and IgM antibodies, which give an indication of active infection or potentially towards the end of infection of COVID-19. So then again, we're dealing with asymptomatic people that we otherwise wouldn't have known about. So we've taken all the appropriate steps there, self-isolating people, keeping them out of the workplace. Captain Don Galizian in our office has done a wonderful job of keeping on top of this, tracking who's had what testing, positive, negative, ensuring that we have a handle on this at all times and keeping not only us safe internally, but keeping the public safe.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chief. Thank you, Councilman Cartier. Other questions from council? Okay, hearing none. Thank you very much, Chief.
Councilman Tackett has one.
Okay, there you go. I got you, Councilman Tackett.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Listen, actually, I want to circle back if possible
for
a quick question with Chief Miller.
All right, Chief Miller, go on with us.
Yep, I see his face, sir. Chief, you the PowerPoint that you presented, is that something that you have the ability to perhaps email over to council?
Yes, actually, while Mark was talking, Chief Logerman, I was making some adjustments to it, and I'm going to email it to Karen probably before we disconnect.
Excellent, perfect. And then the second part of that question was, just because of the magnitude of complaints and calls that I received, over here, it almost sounded like Armageddon, but were the amount of firework calls exuberant this year, or were they about the same as you got in previous years?
I would have to go back and do the research, which is rather easy to do, so I can send a separate report. But I can tell you personally that they were through the ceiling that week of 622. There were 400 of them in 1 week. And that was an increase of well over 100% from the week before.
Yeah. Well, don't do a whole lot of work. I mean, you're busy enough. I don't want to request a lot from you. But I heard that our surrounding states, New Jersey and Pennsylvania, had legalized them to be able to go up in the air now. And that, I guess, added to everybody, you know, going 5 minutes over the line and loading up on fireworks. Because I tell you, I sat outside, you know, 4th of July night, and like, again, it sounded like Armageddon. It was unbelievable, the magnitude. Everybody had fireworks.
So, and as all of you are aware, I live in Edgemoor area, and yes, it sounded like Armageddon. And I can tell you personally, from the experience the 911 call takers are getting, the educational piece is not out to the public that ground-based fireworks are now allowed in Delaware. And the number of people calling about sparklers and the things that are ground-based, it clogs up the system.
Thank you.
Councilman Smiley?
And I'm just going to make a comment that I sent out to all the people that called, emailed, and texted me. Bottom line is the state put it in place, they authorize it, and then they telling everybody to call us because it's a noise issue. A load of freaking crap. If I had my way, they couldn't even have a sparkler out there. Our police shouldn't be running out there responding to confetti poppers and sparklers. That's it. That's my take. It's a waste of resources.
I would agree, and I'd also say that from my experience over the 4th of July weekend, they were much more than sparklers and ground fireworks. And these were everything from cherry bombs to you might think you were at Disney World. Council President Cartley Knight.
You're muted.
You're muted.
Thank you. I'll just make a quick comment, and I had spoke to the chief about it on the 4th of July. I was visiting with constituents down in Brookside around the time the fireworks started going off, the majority of them. And as I was driving home, it was like Armageddon. There was fireworks going over the road. There was fireworks in parking lots, in these strip malls. You know, they were lining up and they're shooting them everywhere. They were it seemed like every family had fireworks going off up in the air. It was a little bit frightening actually driving because they were going right over the road, and they were also falling on they were falling on houses on the roofs. So I don't know what we can do about it, but it really wasn't a safe environment. We certainly want to have fireworks on the 4th of July and have people celebrate, but I think we want to do it a little more safely than how it ended up happening this year.
Okay, with that, any other questions for either Chief Noah or Chief Logan? Okay, if not, thank you, Chief. We'll go on to Colonel Bond. Chief, if you give us an update on Newcastle County PD Police Academy directives, duty to intervening policies. Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon, everyone. And thank you for allowing me to have the opportunity to come before you to discuss briefly some of the updates within the police department. The first thing I would like to start off with is the police academy. We're glad to say that we started our 47th Newcastle County Police Academy on June 22nd. That class consists of 22 individuals, a very diverse class. My hat goes off to Captain Smith and the members of the professional development unit as they made diversity a priority. The breakdown of this class is 11 white males, 5 black males, 1 Hispanic male, 1 Hispanic female, and 4 white females. We also have 3 outside police agencies that are with us as well, to make up the total of 25 in this police academy. And as I said, they have started, and with the COVID-19, we are taking extraordinary measures to ensure that we do not have a problem within our academy. However, I would be lying if I said that it wasn't of concern. As we all know, the virus is spreading, and I've had an opportunity in the command staff to go down and talk to the academy about their responsibilities, both while they're working, but mainly when they're off duty, because these are young people, and as we know, looking at the news, we're seeing a lot of people in their age group that are going out there and not taking the necessary precautions. So once again, we're putting that on them to make sure that they protect themselves so that we do not have any interruptions to this police academy. The next topic of discussion or update is the use of force policy. In light of everything that has been taking place since May 25th, 2020, we have made a decision that we were going to post additional policies on our website. And one of the policies that we recently posted is our use of force policy. I know that there are many people who have expressed an interest in learning more about our use of force policies and how officers are directed and governed when it came to use of force, as well as how these use of force incidents are investigated from within the police department. So if you go to our website, you will have an opportunity to see those. And we are still looking at additional policies that we're going to introduce and post as well, to go along with those that we posted in April of 2019. The next one update is the ban on chokehold policy. As I mentioned before, that anytime when there is a significant incident that takes place involving law enforcement, Chief, if you can go back, I want to see their faces. Anytime when there is a significant incident involving law enforcement, no matter where it is in this country, I think it's always an opportunity for us at Newcastle County Police Department to take a look introspectively at our policies, our training, and our procedures to make sure that we are taking necessary steps so that we don't find ourselves in a situation similar to some of the things that we have seen across this country. And in light of the incidents involving Mr. George Floyd, one of the things that we did was we came back and we talked about a ban on chokehold. And at one particular time, and we're not sure when, it was definitely outlined in our policies that chokeholds were prohibited by members of this agency. We have not trained in chokeholds in any part of our training in weaponless defense. And what we decided was, because it was, when we start reviewing our policies, we found that it wasn't there. We decided that we were going to introduce a policy that dealt with the ban of chokeholds, and we were going to put that into our use of force policy. And the ban on chokehold policy, Trudy, if you can bring that up. This is, this deals specifically with the ban on chokehold. We came up with this language after working together, not only just the command staff, but with the FOP executive staff, as well as County Attorney Jordan Perry, as well as our RAMP unit, which oversees our accreditation and helps to develop policy here at Newcastle County. And as you can see, the policy is very clear and concise. And we're basically telling our officers that they are not to use an instrument or any part of their body to restrict or reasonably believe that it would restrict another subject's ability to breathe by exerting pressure on their neck is prohibited, except when the officer reasonably believes that there is imminent threat of serious physical injury or death to self or others. These physical control techniques include, but are not limited to, those commonly referred to as chokeholds or vascular neck restraints. I think that this wording is all-inclusive. It's very clear. It's very concise. Any violations of this is considered a Class B violation for us, which means that it is suspension with the review for dismissal. The second policy that we instituted, and that policy went into effect on June 23rd. The second policy is the duty to intervene. Sergeant Trudeau will bring that up. And again, this was the result of us looking at and reviewing what has taken place across this country, and making sure that we were clear to our officers, our rank and file, what we mean when we say that there's a duty to intervene. We, prior to this particular directive here, we did have some wording in our policies. However, it was loosely worded. And again, we all agreed that we needed to do things and come up with a policy that would specifically speak to this and make it clear to our officers exactly what they were required to do if they found themselves in a situation. So 2.39A, duty to intervene, simply says, any officer on scene who is knowingly aware that another officer is using force which is beyond objectively reasonable under the circumstances, excessive, inappropriately applied, no longer needed, and or inconsistent with divisional training and policy, shall intervene verbally, and when in a position to do so, safely intercede to stop the use of such force. While still on scene, the intervening officer shall promptly report his or her observations to a supervisor. The supervisor will immediately respond to the scene, if not present, notify their supervisor, and conduct an investigation in accordance with the use of force policy. And again, any violations of this policy are a suspension with a review for dismissal on the first offense.
Hey, Chief. Question or comment from Councilman Carter?
Yeah, I want to really compliment the chief. We've gone back and forth of this quite a bit. They've done a really good job. As you know, I introduced two ordinances concurrent with this. We are in the process. I will be tabling them tonight because Council to Council and I are in the process of providing a substitute to better align them with what has been put into the directives. There are a few things that we're still trying to clear up that maybe you can clear up, Chief. I know talked about the verbiage of the armbar hold that we used in the legislation. I've actually now gone through and read every one of your directives, and we searched them for arm and bar, and we did not find it in the directives. So I know we had confusion about that language that you said you use that for another term. I'm trying to figure out where that term is used, so that I better understand that part of it. And then we could talk a little bit about the exception for, I'll let you answer that one, and I'd like to still talk a little bit about the exception for chokeholds.
Yeah. So the armbar maneuver that we train on has, I want to make it clear, has nothing to do whatsoever with any maneuvers that are around the neck. The armbar maneuver that we train on, it goes with controlling a subject that we have detained or taken into custody. It's a maneuver where you are straightening out that person's arm in a manner that is behind them. And if that person makes a sudden move or they become resistant, it allows you to manipulate their arm so that you are able to place them on the ground and apply handcuffs to them. My concern was, when I looked at the ordinance, was that very similar language was being used in there.
Is it Monique Johns? What are you talking about? Okay, I don't know. Oh, yeah, okay. Azivon or whatever it is.
What? I'm sorry.
Who is speaking?
It might have been Jay. He wasn't muted.
Okay,
he wasn't.
Okay. Actually, that's very helpful, Colonel. And I will talk to Mike about replacing that strictly with chokehold or something to get them consistent. And as I've committed to you, you will see that substitute before I introduce it. So you will still have that chance. The other one that I want to talk about is the exception for use of chokeholds in deadly force situations. I do agree that under deadly force situations, it's understandable. If you're willing to pull a gun to protect your life, you use whatever measure you can if you don't have that gun. But when I go through the directives, particularly under Section 4E and then under Section 6, we do extensive training for the other things that we allow, and then we list those things that we don't allow. And I do believe that even if it is to add to what's in Section 5E and Section 7 of your use of force that talks about the follow-up medical requirements, the risk of using chokeholds, so that all officers clearly understand the impact that it can have if they have to use it and how to respond. Early in your directive, you do have a good policy that requires once your officers have someone back under control, they as quickly as possible stand them up or sit them up. That helps a lot with the damages from chokeholds from prone positions. But I think training shares an equal, if not a greater, responsibility in the department policies than the actual policies. And I'm just deeply concerned that we are now in writing going to write an exception of this being used in deadly force situations without explicitly doing some type of training. Now, I understand you don't want to train on the physical maneuver, but the follow-up might be as simple as really clarifying section, actually 6E and then section 7 of your directives, your use of force directives, to specifically address how we will respond after someone gets under control, assuming they do if you use this. And I think it's important. That helps us give that added protection to community members. It gives good guidance, I think, to our officers, and I think we can do that very clearly. It minimizes litigation. I was shocked when I went back and looked back at the litigation going back to 2003 on problems with chokeholds and their use and the damages that occur. And I think by doing that and then codifying, my hope is, even though I think it's undeserved, some of the potential loss of public trust that might be occurring with our police officers, hopefully by doing this and codifying it will increase it. I think it's somewhat unfair, but it's the world that we're living in now. So I want to really think and talk about some specialized training. And if we can agree that we can do that, even if it's how we respond afterwards or how we tweak how we deal and give medical attention afterwards, I think I'm quite comfortable with that exception. I just see it as a little bit of an anomaly that we train so much on tasers, we train so much on weapons, and then we allow this in a deadly force situation and we're not providing some kind of formal training on it.
Colonel?
You're muted, Colonel.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Councilman. I'm trying to follow exactly what you said. You said quite a bit there, but you're saying that we should have, for the chokehold, have something under the section in our directive that deals with providing medical assistance for use of force incidents?
Yeah, so you have a very specific directive about medical attention and what you do after use of force has occurred. And I think you need to think about the special circumstances and problems with chokeholds and just address that in there so that we know.
But it's okay, but I think what we have here, it pertains to any use of force where a person is injured. And if an officer finds themselves in a situation where they have to utilize a chokehold, that would fall under that category where we were summoned for medical attention. But I guess what you're saying is if the person, if we use the chokehold, but they are not injured, they don't lose consciousness, you're saying we still should have some type of medical attention provided to that person.
Well, yeah. If you look at the studies that were done in D.C. and some of the studies done in California, particularly for tracheal holds, you don't always see it right away. So it was problematic. And, and I just think if we're going to use it as a deadly force option and put that specific in the code, that we really need to talk about the risk and dangers of it.
Okay. I will talk with the command, with the command staff and those that help to put this together. I don't see any harm in putting that language in our directives. So we'll get together and we'll talk about that.
Yeah, and I also wanted to comment. I really appreciate you including the objectively reasonable standard based on Graham and Connor. That's a really big improvement, from some of the stuff we have in the state code. And it just shows how progressive and out the front UCAS County Police are. I really appreciate that a lot. I think it's very helpful. So just so you know, Colonel, as we talked about a week ago, we will be doing, I'll be tabling the ordinances tonight. We will be doing a substitute to much better align them and recognize that the good work that has been done. And if we can work out that last little piece about adding some of the training and formal stuff for the exception use of chokeholds, that we will go ahead and I think we'll be able to incorporate that as well.
Okay, well, just my position, sir, with all due respect, is I still have concerns about it going into code. Mm-hmm. I still have several questions that remain unanswered, and I guess if you're going to bring it up at a later time, we can talk about it, and I can raise those questions at that time.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that, and I know we've talked about that a few times, and I think in the environment we are in, I think it makes sense to have it not just as a administrative directive, but an administrative directive that is also supported in code so that you will have that oversight if it gets changed later. So we'll talk about that some more.
Council President Hartley Nagel.
Yes, I want to thank the chief for the multiple conversations we have had and bring up a couple things. One of them that we were talking about was if you're in a fight for your life. And the chief brought up a great example to me. He said, Council President, if you were in a fight for your life, you would do anything you had to do to save your life. If you bite them, you scratch them, you do whatever you have to do. And so I want to make sure that our officers aren't afraid and that whatever we craft, that they know that if they're in that situation, that they have to save their life. They are able to do that, willing to do that without fear. The other thing I was concerning me is I'm out in the community and speaking with people and also on Zoom meetings. I'm hearing that people believe that we're not doing training. And Chief, I know that we've had conversations. We do a lot of training. So I want you to go over some of the training that we do and what that covers. Because I was really concerned hearing that people believe that we don't do training for the chokeholds, for a number of things, because I know that we train for, almost nearly everything. Is that not correct?
Yes, ma'am. My question is, what training would you like me to cover? We have an academy that is six months long, where we cover everything ranging from ethics to firearms training to weaponless defense to cultural diversity to implicit bias to diversity, cultural awareness. There's a lot of Title 11, Title 21, Title 16, county ordinances. There are a multitude of trainings that we we have and that we put our officers through. So is there any particular training?
They were making overall blanket statements, but I'm glad that you listed those things because I want to make sure, I want our constituents to know that not only are we protecting them, but that also we have extensive training in place, that this is ongoing. It is not just one time. And that, you know, we are covering all those areas that you just discussed, including, you know, the, you know, all of the information that Councilman Carter had listed as well.
Right. And, you know, I would like to point out that we're also doing the bias-based policing. That's part of our training that we've done. You know, the implicit bias there, you know, like I said, there are a lot of it. And what I would like to recommend to any of our community members is that we have our Citizens Police Academy. And I recognize it's only 9 weeks, but I think it gives a great insight as to the type of training that our officers undergo. You know, contrary to popular belief, our police academy, the first few days, yes, it's about bringing structure and order and bringing a group of individuals together so that they can learn how to operate as one. And so the first week or so at our police academy, yes, we are trying to induce a lot of stress in them. There is a lot of yelling, there's a lot of screaming, there's a lot of push-ups. But if you had an opportunity to go to one of our police academy graduations, what you'll find is that when at the end, towards the end of the graduation, they always show a video. And that video is a telltale sign of everything that they went through during the course of that academy. And so that first week you see where they walk in there that very first day and they come in and they're all squared away, their uniforms are put together, and they're coming in with their duffel bags full of equipment and they're excited. And then all hell breaks loose. And it's done on purpose. It becomes chaotic. And you see them sweating. You see them doing push-ups and sit-ups all day long. They can't do anything right. But as that video progresses, what you start to see is the classroom portion that's taking place. Our academy is probably one of the most rigorous academic police academies you're going to find. It's put on by some of the best instructors that we can find both in-house and outside of our department. And so what you see is a focus on the academic part of it, because the academics are what keeps us afloat as a police department, that officers know what they should do, that they understand the law, that they understand ordinances. And so a great deal of our time is spent on that. Also incorporated in our academy, and if you look at the video, you're going to see that these recruits are involved in a great deal of community outreach, whether they're running 5Ks, whether they're helping out with the Special Olympics, whether they're going and feeding homeless. They're doing so many things because what we're trying to get them to understand is that we are a community policing organization. And what we're trying to ingrain in them right from day one is the need for them to recognize that they are a critical part to this community, to the communities that we serve. And so, you know, like I said, it is the academy and the training and so forth. I can surely get you a copy of the curriculum for our police academy, and it will list out there exactly who is training, how many hours are spent in this training as well. So if you think that would be helpful, that's something that I can arrange to get to all of council.
Yeah, thank you. It's greatly appreciated, Chief.
True, make note of that.
Okay, thank you, Chief. Co-Chairman Street.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I feel like I'm watching Wild World of Sports because I know the thrill of victory, and now I feel the agony of defeat. And I'm glad y'all are having such a politically correct conversation and that things have worked out so well. And the progressive police force doesn't need anything codified, and ultimately, we don't need a ban on chokehold. Well, I'll accept the agony of defeat for now. I suggest that the legislation
not be tabled, be withdrawn. And as I said in the paper, it's not worth the paper it's printed on anyway, nor is the governor's so-called executive order, nor is the legislation that he hasn't signed. None of it's worth the paper it's written on, because we're either going to ban chokeholds or we're not. And the language that y'all are talking about inserting here is consistent with the language that is in the legislation that passed the General Assembly, and it's tied right to Title 11, 464, which is the problem. And we can agree to disagree. But as I said, and the reporter got it absolutely correct, if George Floyd had happened in Delaware, the cops would have walked because of 464. Now, the General Assembly has made it crystal clear, police is in charge of them, and the police had two victories last week with the school districts, and they think they're going to keep running the schools, but I don't think that's going to happen. And ultimately, the will of council be the will of council, and it's up to the county exec. If consistent with the General Assembly and consistent with schools think they're going to do, we're going to let the police run the county, then so be it. But I won't be a part of it. And if you don't withdraw the legislation, take my name off of it as a co-sponsor, and I won't be supporting.
Thank you, Co-Chairman. You know, I can't help but to add comment. The last couple meetings, and I think when we look at what the situation is, what occurred in this country, what continues to occur in this country, I think that we have to look close to home when we start to do comparables with other law enforcement agencies in this country. Because clearly, there are a multitude, a large majority of law enforcement agencies in this country that do not have the policies, the procedures, the certifications, the training that our Newcastle County Police has. And I'm not making an excuse for anything, and I'm not saying that mistakes aren't made, and I'm not saying that improvements can't be made. But I think, Colonel, you'll verify, Newcastle County Police is one of a very small group of law enforcement agencies in this nation that attain the gold standard of accreditation by the Commission on Law Enforcement Accreditation internationally, worldwide. Throughout 4 years, the process now is ongoing with the accreditation manager and assistants in each department, and every policy, every procedure, all of our training, everything that occurs within the Newcastle County Police Department is continually reviewed and observed by a group of law enforcement professionals that serve on this commission. And the commission are made up of not only law enforcement, but education, civilian, and you have representation, equal representation on that commission. So I just mentioned that because, you know, we all recognize what's occurred. Wasn't good then, still isn't good. And yes, I think we have to do everything humanly possible to protect the citizens of Newcastle County from becoming a victim of what's occurred in other areas. But at the end of the day, I really think it's incumbent upon all of us to at least have no doubt in our minds that we still have a county police department that is a cut above the rest. The programs, the policies, the procedures, what they've accomplished, not just locally, but nationally, they're a model for other law enforcement agencies in this country and this world. Some of the programs that the very programs that they receive federal grants, and we've complimented that they go after funds to look for not just police patrol and operations, but to look at health, mental health, the opiate epidemic, working in the community, things that we talk about almost every public safety committee meeting. So I agree that we need to assure and make sure and reassure our public that we're not going to tolerate what occurs and has occurred in other areas. But I think we also need to be strong and stand up for an organization in law enforcement that I consider one of the best in the nation. So I'll leave it with that comment and everything. And I appreciate the work that the Colonel's done in communicating with us since the last meeting. We've had several conversations. I appreciate the work that Councilman Carter has done. And make no mistake about it. I don't for one minute, and I don't think anyone else condones some of the things that have happened in this country and in our area and neighboring areas. But I also don't want to lose sight that we have an excellent county police department. President Pro Tem Hollins and then Co-Chairman Street.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to add a couple of comments here from my personal observation and experience. I'm sure I'm not the only member of council who has been doing extensive reading and research in the past month because of what's been sweeping the nation. And I would agree with you and anyone else, that we have a very good police department here in Newcastle County, Delaware, probably would stand with the best. But I also believe that there's not a perfect police department in these United States of America. And even though we have an excellent, if you want to say, police department, there's also room for improvement. We have the second largest police department in the state of Delaware. And we are in the state of Delaware. Delaware has the most restrictive, arguably, protections for police than any other state in this nation. I would challenge anyone to do the research on policing in Delaware to some of the history. So we're not exempt. If you were to look at some of the families and look at one family as one too many, you would recognize that in Delaware, police officers are protected to the extent that in most other jurisdictions, it just would not be accepted, even in states like Florida and Georgia. When Jeremy McDowell was shot and killed on the streets of Wilmington by the Wilmington police, the Attorney General made it very clear that had that happened in most other states in this country, there would have been a conviction. So we can't be blinded because we have an excellent police department and assume that everyone is getting equal protection. I have not gone to the police academy. I believe what the chief is saying. I don't believe that the police academy actually trained police officers to brutalize black communities, but I do know it happens, and I can't be silent toward that. When I look at reports from across this country, and while there are good police departments, even the one we have here, even the study that was done at the University of Delaware, only 36% of black people in the state of Delaware, not black people in Mississippi, Alabama, or anyplace else, feels that they are equally protected by the police. It just seems to me that it's time for the police and the FOP to work with government, work with legislators, to make certain that all of our citizens feel protected by the police. It just seems to me that any attempt to make reasonable changes to the police department is met with such fierce opposition when everyone knows that we have this challenge with too many of our people. And it just blows my mind away that when we talk about some reforms, that's assumed that it's an indictment on the police department. It just seems to me that the FOP would welcome an opportunity to work with legislators. What is so wrong with having police procedures codified? And on the other side, we know that during negotiations with FOP, there's always changes being made. I would much prefer the hard work that has been done so far by this colonel and the officers that is codified, that it moves on for the next police chief. But to have a situation where it can be negotiated away to the next cycle, it's just not really meaningful. So it just seems, rather than for everyone to get so in a position of defensiveness, let's look at the real data and what that real data shows. And the real data is not something that was crafted by me, but anyone is free for anyone who wants to read it. So jurisdictions across this country has recognized and accepted ways to improve their police forces with the public. And I can understand why in Newcastle County, Delaware, with the largest, second largest force in the state of Delaware, would be so reluctant. Even when I read from the city of Dover, the Dover police chief coming forward, we have been, in my opinion, very silent. I've seen the pretty words that came from the county executive about how he feels, but no action has been taken. There is room for improvement. And I think if anyone was a reasonable person would recognize that, and we should not take it as improvement, as somewhat of a mistrust of police, or police is doing something wrong. But police can be better like any other institution that we have. And I think it's time for us to make it better, make it all it can be. And more importantly, make the police department available to all people, and that at least we have more people in more communities of color feeling like they are protected, as opposed to feeling as though they are afraid of the very system that they pay their tax money to protect them. I think that we got a long ways to go here. These are not earth-shattering things that we're talking about. But when you look across the country and you look at the FOP and what they really believe in, even though these things are fought, culture would tell you they exist. Even what happened in Allentown, Pennsylvania, last night and night before, even what happened down in Wilmington, North Carolina, a couple of weeks ago, these are all police forces. What happened in Philadelphia just last year, year before, these are all police officers. They are not perfect. They come from the same community that we live in. So I think to suggest that anyone is perfect or any institution is perfect, especially with the challenge that police has, is just pretty short-sighted. So I look forward to working to make our police force better, look forward to working to make certain that people of color can have more confidence in the police as to being afraid of the police. And no one can tell me that that's not the case. And as I said, even though I have not been in the police academy, I served 6 years active duty in the military with 2 hardship tours, so I know what it means to be sworn to serve. And you can serve and serve respectfully and still be concerned with the sanctity of dignity and life for all people. And that's what I'm working toward, nothing more or nothing less. But I believe that we can make improvements of what we have today.
Thank you, Mr. President Pro Tem, Co-Chairman Street, and then President Hartley Nagel.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to be brief. And I listened attentively after I got tongue-lashed at the last public safety meeting to the comments made. And the chief was specific about accreditation that we had, and only 800 out of 18,000 in the country had. Well, 9 agencies in the state of Delaware have the same accreditation, one of which is the Wilmington Police Department, where they blew Jeremy McDowell away in a wheelchair. And we act as though what I talked about that happened in August of 2012 when county police shot that boy in the back of the head and killed him, that didn't happen. Roger Brown didn't happen. And the 14-year-old that says he got tased in the face and his friend that was with him got beat up severely, all those things didn't happen. I'm just plucking these things out of the air and picking on the police department for no reason. Well, You know, I really hope in my heart that what y'all are agreeing to is okay. And if this doesn't come back to haunt y'all, because it won't be haunting me. But at the end of the day, and I said it after the conclusion of the Dole investigation by the city of Wilmington, I'm down there acting like I'm 20, wrestling with young men who the only reason something didn't happen to me it was out of just love and respect, because I really couldn't restrain anybody. But I put that, me and Mouse and others in the community put that fire out. But the next fire that gets started, be assured of one thing. I'm not going to put out any more fire that I didn't start. And whatever we do or don't do going forward, we'll have to live with. But I'll take the defeat for now. But I doubt seriously if this is over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Council President Hartland Eagle.
Yes, thank you, sir. I just wanted to say, and the chief can probably comment on this also. From personal experience, I will call the chief when constituents call me. And it's not always an easy conversation, and I will ask for information. Oh, here goes the lights again. It's motion censored. And so we will, I will ask him, you know, what happened in a situation. One that I'll mention too. One is on the 4th of July, the constituents that I was visiting with were a group of many neighbors that had had a problem with another neighbor. I asked the chief for information on that. He sent the police out again because the neighbors weren't satisfied with the result. And after that, again, I asked him for the report, which he shared with me. And I shared those findings, you know, didn't show them the report, but they didn't ask, but I told them what was in it. And we talked about what they could do differently and what that other person could do differently. And when I was there the 4th of July, there was no problems with the neighbor, nor had they had any problems in the 2 weeks since the initial, another incident had happened and the 4th of July. And so it's not that I don't question. I believe in trust but verify. So it's not a blind faith. As the chief has said, we always can improve. We can always can do better. But our constituents have to trust us. They have to know that we're constantly checking and checking again. And the chief has no problem with making sure that I get that information to verify and validate to my constituents what is happening. And when they have that information and they have more information and you're working with them and talking to them, they have more trust in us, that we're going to also look after them. It's not about just protecting the police. It's about making sure our constituents have a quality of life. You know, the second incident on the 4th of July, Chief, as you know, was the shootings of three individuals in Rosegate. And I have friends that were over there that night, and there was about 500 people. Three were shot. The people that were hosting the event didn't even know anybody had been shot. And it was overall a good event. Well, I went back after the chief and I talked about what had happened that night, but also a couple days later, and then also followed up with the friends that I have that live in that area that knew about that incident. And what they said to me about the police, because I want to know, is that they were courteous, they were kind, respectful, there was no problem, and that they were grateful for the Newcastle County Police being there. Now, in that kind of a situation with 500 people at a party, three people shot, you might think that that wouldn't happen, but there was no chaos. It was organized. It was kept more low-key, and they did their job, and everybody was, it appeared to me, and this is what was relayed back to me, everybody was satisfied. So, you know, this is about not just taking their word for it or just supporting blindly the police. It is a check all the time. It is always checking with your constituents what is happening, making sure they're protected, but also making sure that our police are protected and the truth is getting out there. And the truth, and that these are things that are happening now, today. This is how our police department, from my perspective, is operating. And I believe they're doing a really good job And if they're not, I want to hear about that. And I think the chief knows. Yeah. I'll have him on the phone. So, and I think many of the other council members do the same thing as I do. And so this is just not blind trust. This is a constant checking and checking in with the community and our police force.
Okay, Councilman Carter.
Yeah, I just want to clarify and let all of council know that we will be coming through with a substitute. I will have the colonel review that as well, and we'll put it up with a vote. I'll talk to Councilman Street and happy to remove his name. You know, one of the things that I can tell you, having just read the 21st century policing report that was done under the Obama administration and the national report by other chiefs, that openness and transparency is really important to maintaining trust. And while I think a lot of what, and almost all of what was developed in these policies is good, I think we do need to open it up. I think by tabling today, it gives the public 2 weeks to take a look at it and to review it. And I do this in all honestness, because I believe that transparency will help strengthen the trust of our police force. You know, whether all agree with me or not, I think it's really, really important. There are people that are really concerned. We got a whirlwind out there. It's really hard to see with all this crazy commentary and protesting going on, you know, the bright side to that type of whirlwind, but society has changed, including Delaware. And I think we need to do this openly. I think we need to codify it. The will of council be the will of council. I want to get it as much in line with the good advice from the colonel and his command staff, because, you know, that's where we'll have the best possibility of implementation in a good way. And so I just wanted to make sure that everybody knows what my intentions are going forward. And I will ask Council President tonight, even though I'm going to be tabling it, that you give some latitude and flexibility. If the public wants to speak, please give them an opportunity to speak on these, because I want to hear that 2 weeks in advance of when we would be voting on something, in case some new ideas come through that we need to consider. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman. Any other comment, Colonel Bond?
Yes, sir. Just briefly, I would like to briefly respond to Councilman Hollins and some of the things that he said. First and foremost, I want to make it clear to everyone that at no point in time have I ever proclaimed Newcastle County Police Department to be perfect. We are made up of human beings. We are not robots. We will have officers, including myself, who will periodically make mistakes, and we have to address that and we have to deal with it. On July 9th, I had a department-wide Zoom meeting. And during that Zoom meeting, I talked about the current state of affairs across this country and the perception of law enforcement. And I recognize that there are some law enforcement officials across this country that are resistant to change. And those that are, as I see daily in the police executive research media material that I receive, many of those individuals are retiring because they are not open to change. And the message that I delivered to our department the other day was quite frankly this, that whether you like it or not, change is coming. And if we are sincere in our efforts to gain the trust of the community and to gain the trust of those that we serve, we have to be open to that change. We have to take a position as law enforcement, as an agency, myself as the chief of police, take a position of being open and willing to sit down at the table to make these changes. In all honesty, as I explained to the executive board of the Delaware Police Chiefs Council, I am not opposed to many of the changes, and nor are many of the chiefs of police from Delaware opposed to many of the changes that have been recommended by community members and recommended by politicians. So I don't want to leave anyone with the impression that we are resisting. Our concerns about the ordinances as they are presented, there are several questions that I have that I feel should be answered prior to any implementation of an ordinance. Because after all, we're talking about holding officers accountable. Some of the questions that I had, and I can get into it a little bit later, but there are a list of questions. And so before a police department and me in my position agree to something like this, I would simply like to have an opportunity to have those questions answered. And Councilman Carter and I have discussed, and we have talked quite a few times, some of the questions I posed to him. You know, I know that he's working on, and I imagine that sometime over the next week or so, we are going to have additional conversation that I can take back to the command staff, the FOP, and if not, involve them in the conversation that we're having with Councilman Carter. But I just want to make sure that we understand that everyone understands that I am not opposed to it, and nor do I want any member of this agency to be opposed to change. This is an opportunity for us in law enforcement to turn things around. Nothing hurts more than the fact that many of us and many people have now turned to us and look at us as the villains. And nothing could be further from the truth. We talked about this. And so to me, Councilman Hollins, I hope that you would understand where I'm coming from. I think that, you know, looking at both of these issues, the chokehold as well as the duty to intervene in other areas are surely worthy of it. They're worthy of exploration. We should be looking at them. We should take a look and see how we can better. I think that we have taken that step and we have shown. It didn't take anyone to come and beat on our doors and say, you need to change this. As I said earlier, we always look and we always search. What I realized with success and any accomplishment is you can't rest on what you did yesterday. We always have to continue to look because the demands on policing changes every day. When I started on this police department, we had a binder of directives. We had one binder that was our directives that detail what we should and shouldn't do as police officers. Today, when you print out all of our directives, we're up to two full binders. And I imagine in another few years, we'll be up to three full binders. If we weren't open to change, we would still be at one binder. But because we look and we're constantly challenging ourselves to get better, we're increasing our policies to make sure that our level of service and delivery of service exceeds the expectation that the community has of us. I think it's important, and one thing that I don't hear quite a bit, and I know that Councilman Street mentioned it, was the accreditation and the fact that we have several departments in this state that are accredited. And I think that that's a good thing. But I think it's a problem, as I told Lisa Blunt Rochester, Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester, that if I were in a position such as her and such as you all here in County Council, I think that one of the things I would really push for is accreditation for all departments across this country. Because as Councilman Bell has clearly stated earlier, the importance of that. And what we find when you start to peel back the layers on some of these uses of force and some of the departments that are involved in them, they have policies that are very outdated. They have some policies that quite frankly don't exist. And those agencies who do not want to take on that responsibility are the agencies that create the problem for the agencies that are trying to do it the correct way. So when you have conversation, I hope that the conversation extends beyond just Newcastle County and the state of Delaware, but it goes to this country overall, that there should be a mandate and a push for accreditation. I can assure you that it does make a difference. And if you start to really look at the agencies that find themselves in situations, you'll find out that there are a lot of underlying issues that had they been accredited or had to undergo an accreditation process, perhaps those issues wouldn't have happened. I'm very proud of the fact that we're currently undergoing it right now. And just a couple weeks ago, and I'm gonna send this email to everyone on council, but one of the assessors sent an email to us and said that our policies and our procedures were among the best that he has ever seen. We take pride in that. And like I said, we're not a perfect agency. We're not. We have a lot of work to do. But as I said earlier, we do get a lot of things right. A lot of the things that the community across this country have been calling for, as I shared with our department the other day, we're doing the body-worn cameras, the implicit bias, the bias-based policing, the community outreach. And a lot of that has paid off for us. It's paid off in great ways. You know, it wasn't until July 4th that we had our first homicide of the year. And that's one too many. We've had 14 shootings this year. That's 14 too many. My goal, as unrealistic as it may be, is to not have any homicides and to not have any shootings. Our numbers are at that level because of the men and women that are here and because of the direction that this police department has been in since I've been here 29 years and before me. The foundation that the retirees laid for us, and we're simply following up on that. We're putting a lot more emphasis on community policing, something we've always done. But I think that those are making a difference. I think that that's the reason why a couple of Tuesdays ago, we didn't have protests here at our police station, but we had a prayer, police and prayer service here in front of our building that was attended by many who enjoyed themselves. I know it doesn't look like it's interesting to some of you here. I'm watching you and I see that and I apologize, but I just feel a need to point that out and to make it clear that we are not resistant to change. We're open to change, but I do believe we have a right to have any questions we have answered, just like you would want that same thing from me. Thank you.
Thank you. Go Chairman Street.
Whenever you get the other, I do have something on the other, and I know we're already running late.
Okay. So we'll go to, is there anyone in the queue for any public comment at this time? Okay, hearing none, we'll go to other and then to adjournment.
Councilman Bell, there is one person, Christine Bricker, would like to speak. Just unmute your microphone. Go ahead and unmute yourself and make your comments.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you can.
Okay, thank you. I want to thank the council members who introduced the two ordinances about police reform, the one about banning chokeholds and also the one about duty to intervene and report. I think that these are the bare minimum that we can do, especially given that my understanding is that Chief Bond says that there are already practices. Since we don't have transparency, I think it's very important that to increase public confidence in the police that we have these laws on the books. I do know that our police department is not perfect. I have to pass the memorial of a young man who was shot by Newcastle County Police every time I go to the grocery store. And that memorial's in my neighborhood. And I do also know that unfortunately, despite it being a banned practice in a lot of police departments, that having your breathing restricted is unfortunately somewhat, it happens a lot. It happened to me when I was 17, not here in the state of Delaware. But it was not a chokehold. It was officers compressing my chest with their full weight so that I could not expand my chest. I'm not even sure that this would be banned under the current ordinance. And so I would, just like to stress that I do believe that these ordinances are the very bare minimum that we could possibly do to respond to the uprising that's been going on across the country. So again, thank you again for raising this. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. And thank you especially, Councilman Hollins, for what I think was, really well said. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Bricker. We appreciate your comments. And we'll move on to other with County Council, Co-Chairman Street.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to be brief. But at the initial protest in the city of Wilmington, I saw footage of what appeared to be our military vehicle that I called a tank. I don't know what it's actually called. And there are expert opinions on how to respond to civil disobedience, potential civil disobedience. And being somebody who was on the street in the 60s when the National Guard was on the street, and being somebody who got a bayonet put in his face for wearing a red, green, and black hat, being somebody that witnessed females being harassed with bayonets, not even allowed to come out of the house, and all those stories that have been in the public press. There were those in the 60s who said the military response to potential civil unrest and civil unrest is appropriate. There are other experts who adamantly disagree. Now, you know, the police department, obviously from this conversation, is going to continue to be in charge in this county, and I'll have to live with that. But I do not agree in any way, shape, form, or fashion that a military response is appropriate to civil unrest and potential civil unrest. And the fact of the matter is, within 2 or 3 weeks, county police conducted, 2 or 3 weeks after that, county police conducted another military style operation, getting somebody out of a house. Now, y'all can continue down this road if you want, but I'm telling you right now, you're going to end up starting a fire if it doesn't change, that nobody's going to be able to put out. And I don't like it. I don't agree with it. And I resent it. The other question is, I have, need not be answered today, and I don't really don't want to hear any more philosophical speeches. But at the point where you got the state police, county police, city police on the street responding to civil disobedience, apparently somebody somewhere gave a do not engage order. My question and my concern is, when that happens, who's in charge? Who makes the decision with our officers as to when or when not to engage? And my final question is, whatever that military vehicle is, whatever you call it, what the hell were you going to blow up if something happened? As far as I'm concerned, that piece of equipment needs to be put somewhere and taken off the street, because ultimately it has the potential of starting more problems, creating more problems than it can resolve. Now, not part of the administration, this conversation, this whole meeting makes it clear that, as it's been for a long time, police are going to be in charge, but that's not going to continue without me standing up and saying what I actually think about it. And I thank you for the time at the end of the meeting, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Motion's in order.
The chief wants to respond.
Chief, Colonel?
Yes, sir. Very briefly, what I would like to say to the comments by Councilman Street about the our deployment into the city of Wilmington for the protest, that was under the mutual aid. Chief Tracy contacted us because they had concerns about the protests growing violent that evening and asked if we would be willing to be on standby for them. And as we all know, that particular evening was probably the most violent evening that took place in the city of Wilmington. However, I would like to point out that at no time were any Newcastle County police officers involved in making any arrests, nor did we do any more than simply stand by as added security to protect those protesters as well as some of the nearby businesses that took place. One of the ways that we transport our SWAT team members is by way of the Linko, which is our armored vehicle. And so I think that there's a time and a place for this armored vehicle. I can understand the concerns if the officers were driving around in the Linko and answering calls for service, pulling up in front of somebody's house because of a loud radio complaint, if they were pulling up in front of their house in the armored vehicle. However, we don't use it for that purpose. The second incident that was pointed out by Councilman Street, yes, we did go a few weeks later. We had an armed robbery investigation where a suspect produced a handgun, pointed it at a victim, threatening to shoot that victim unless they turned over property that belonged to them, that were turned over property to the suspect. During the course of our investigation, we identified this suspect. This suspect was found to have an extensive criminal history that included drugs and weapons. During a subsequent investigation, we found out that this suspect that we were looking for was one of the two suspects that were involved in a sporting goods burglary wherein 35 rifles, high-powered rifles, and handguns were stolen. There was no question whatsoever that the person we were looking for the armed robbery that we had arrest warrants and search warrants for was a person who was in the surveillance video at the sporting goods store. We do what we call a threat assessment, where we break down for any search warrant, arrest warrant, search warrant that we're going to produce, that we're going to execute. We do a threat assessment where we lay out the person's criminal history, we assign points, and we look at the events, the circumstances, the investigation, and the potential for violence occurring during the search warrant or arrest actions. Needless to say, this individual was off the chart. So our decision was to utilize our SWAT team in order to go into an address located in the city of Wilmington, the Hilltop area, to carry out this search warrant and this arrest warrant. Again, this person was involved not only in our armed robbery, but they were involved in a burglary where 35 rifles and high-powered rifles and handguns were taken. If that's not a situation that you're going to use your SWAT team and your armored vehicle for, then I don't know what is. I'm surely not going to call the Girl Scouts of America and ask them to carry it out. So I'm confused. Again, we are using this equipment responsibly and on occasion. Take, for example, the murder of Stephen Ballard. There were armored vehicles down there that allowed our officers to get closer to the suspect's residence. Our vehicles, our Tahoes and the Crown Vicks do not provide that type of protection. Look at the Veterans Cemetery incident that happened a couple months ago, where that suspect was armed with a high-powered rifle and fired several rounds into the windshield of the armored vehicle owned by the Delaware State Police. I can assure you that the officers that were behind that armored vehicle, if they were standing behind a Tahoe or a Crown Vic, in all likelihood, they wouldn't be here today. So there's a place and a time for those armored vehicles. Again, we're not using them to ride around and handle regular routine complaints. There's a time and a place for them. And so for Councilman Street to insinuate that we are careless with them is a far stretch from the truth and our reality.
Well, that's your reality. And you're not going to just keep on coming to me with this condescending malarkey. My concern is my concern. And you weren't coming up 2nd Street at 8:30 in the morning with folks all out in the street concerned and feeling like their neighborhood's being terrorized with this military operation. And it's not in your council matter district. And people in the city of Wilmington don't call you about concerns and problems that they have. So
did you share
that philosophical, condescending mess if you want? Experts have different opinions as to when and when not to use military-style tactics. And the fact of the matter is you went to get one person and you had probably 15 cars up there plus other people in military attire and a military vehicle. And, you know, this happens in the city of Wilmington. It happened down the street from the center that I retired from. The feds come in and they don't have to have anybody's permission, but that was in between two daycare centers. And all this goes on in our community, and I'm supposed to stand idly by and allow you to talk about a Girl Scout operation? You need to play with people who play.
Okay.
Well, what I will say, sir, is that...
And let's bring this to a close. Bring point of order.
I'm sorry. Person killed Trooper Ballard. One person killed Lieutenant Joe Zerban. One person killed the two officers yesterday or the day before yesterday in Texas. One person killed the officer in
That being the
Ohio.
Case, you should use military operations everywhere you go. If that's your philosophy, that's your philosophy.
Okay?
But the opinion that the only opinion that is correct is yours is just not correct. And whether you like it or not, I am entitled to my opinion, and yes, I don't agree with these consistent military operations in neighborhoods where children are there and communities are impacted. And the people who suffer under the National Guard being on the street, some of us, including me, never get over it. And I'm not going to sit here and allow and say nothing when I see the potential for younger people living in the city now to have to go through the same thing. Because somebody arbitrarily and capriciously decides that it's okay to bring this kind of this level of enforcement into a neighborhood where there are children.
Okay, at this point in time, I'm going to ask for someone to move for adjournment.
Motion to adjourn.
Motion made and seconded to adjourn. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So carried. Finance Chairman?
Yes, we will.